¡Confirmo! ¡Argentina no puede el mundo!
Supernatural goal from Lionel Messi.
Ronaldinho takes and David Seaman's call off his line and Brazil take the lead. Oh, how about that?
Shaqiri. Here is Shaqiri. Is this the moment for Shaqiri? Yes!
Destination 2026, Houston's Countdown to the Cup.
Presented by Coca-Cola Southwest, Houston Methodist, NRG, and Quanta.
From the Huntington Bank Studios, here's Glenn Davis.
All right, away we go tonight with Destination 2026, Houston's Countdown to the Cup, brought to you by Houston Methodist, Coca-Cola Southwest, NRG, Quanta, Aramco and Visit Sugarland. Welcome in, everybody, on the heels of a great night last night with Soccer Matters ESPN 97.5. Well, tonight we aim to have another interesting show for you. We are going to profile tonight the 1982 World Cup that was held in Spain, significant for a lot of reasons. So we'll talk about that tonight. We've got England national team talk. England has won the World Cup once, 1966, with the legendary Bobby Moore as the captain of the team. Well, Bobby Moore, 1 year after winning the World Cup as the host nation with England, Bobby Moore and Jeff Hurst came here to Houston, Texas. This is 1967, with West Ham United to take on Real Madrid in the Astrodome, considered the eighth wonder of the world at the time. Now, the Astrodome still sits here in Houston, Texas, but there is another connection, obviously, to the World Cup with the Astrodome and then the visit of West Ham United taking on Real Madrid. You had the man, Bobby Moore, who lifted up the Jules Rimet trophy, symbolic of winning the World Cup back then. So that's pretty interesting. Also, the legendary Pelé came to Houston a number of times, but he played in the Astrodome as well. And, of course, Pelé won the World Cup three times with legendary Brazilian squads and is one of the most historic players in the history of the game, as you all know. So there's another connection to the World Cup. And Pelé then came in the 80s for a UNICEF game between the Houston Dynamos of that time. That's plural with an S, who took on the San Jose Earthquakes, and Pelé came into town as, just the guy who brought the game ball out and made rounds around Houston, Texas, and helped promote this UNICEF initiative that was going on all around the world. So good memories there. Got to meet the legendary Pelé after watching him as a teenager. I used to go to Giants Stadium and watch him with the New York Cosmos. So there are a lot more World Cup connections here in Houston than you know. We lost the legendary Jaime La Chalona Rodriguez, who was on the 1982 team, which went to the World Cup in Spain recently. And my understanding is that Jaime was living here in Houston. So we'll dedicate the show tonight to La Chalona. Jaime Rodriguez, formerly star with El Salvador that went to the World Cup. All right, we stream at ESPN975.com. You can always find the podcasts of the show at Spotify, Google, and right here, ESPN975.com. You can also get Soccer Matters over there as well. Last night we were noshing on slip sliders. Great sliders last night. That was a lot of fun. FWC26Houston.com. That's where you can get information on World Cup merchandise specific to Houston. It's also where you can learn about tickets, all the great turnout for volunteers. FWC26Houston.com. Say it again, FWC26Houston.com. This past Monday, we were out at the Aurora Picture Show on the East End. We did the 1978 film, which was held in Argentina winning their first World Cup. It was called Campeones. That was our version of Monday Night Football. The next version will be Gole, the 1982 World Cup version. This will be held in Market Square from 6 to 8 p.m., and it's going to be coming up next month. So we'll get more information on that. You can go to Monday Night Football, F-U-T-B-O-L, 1982.eventbrite.com. Okay, so we'll talk a little bit about the 1982 FIFA World Cup right now. So let's get into it. So 1982 was held in Spain, and it was an intriguing tournament for a lot of reasons. Things were happening in the evolution of the game tactically. There were things going on competitively that were different. Spain hosted it in the summer of 82, literally about a month tournament. So for the first time, it went from 16 teams to 24. Now, it's interesting to think about that. We're on the abyss now of the first time ever 48 teams, and there's even talk of going to 64 4 years from now. So this was a big deal then, going from 16 to 24. Italy won their third title in 1982. The runner-up was West Germany. The great Poland team ended up in third. So this was Paolo Rossi, and Rossi had played in the 78 World Cup. Paolo Rossi was a bit of a controversial figure, was banned from soccer for a while. I think it was match fixing. Didn't play and didn't score a lot in the group stages, but ended up winning the Golden Boot with six goals and winning the number one player of the World Cup. Now, there were some newbies that got into this tournament. Algeria, Cameroon, Honduras, Kuwait, New Zealand, which I think if you go back to 1982, you might not have pulled those teams out of the hat. There were six groups of four teams. Second round, 12 teams are divided into four groups of three, and then you had a semifinal and a final. Italy did not start the tournament well. They had three draws, and they only advanced basically on goals scored. I mean, barely scraped through. So they didn't win a game in the group stages. They had draws against Poland, Peru, and Cameroon. Rossi, like I said, he had been banned for 2 years. He was involved in a betting scandal. This guy then goes nuts, okay, basically in the knockout stages. Hat trick against Brazil. They claim this is one of the greatest World Cup matches ever. It was a 3-2 win for Italy in that one. But again, this is a guy who did not score in the group stages. They scrape by. They only advance on goal average. They're going to go on to win the World Cup. They beat Brazil 3-2. He hits for a hat trick there. Semifinals, Italy goes through Poland. He gets two there, and then he scores in the final against West Germany. So this is an example. And I often talk a lot about this with the U.S. national team. Tournaments are navigation. Italy showed you this was navigation. Barely scraped through the first round, but then you peak at the right time. You find your game. You find motivation. You find momentum. Things click. The hand of fate is on your side. Whatever it is, we all know that tournaments can be momentum-based. And lots of things can unleash the fury and potential of momentum. Could be a singular game, could be a singular moment, could be a singular play. So Italy peaks perfectly. Obviously, the tactics and the discipline and the defensive smarts of the great Italian teams, this is all on display. The final is a 3-1 victory over West Germany. Paolo Rossi has one of the goals, Marco Tardelli and Altobelli. And Paul Breitner got the West Germany goal. If you remember the Marco Tardelli celebration where he scores and he's pumping his arms equally in front of him around the 18 after scoring is one of the iconic sort of celebrations in the history of the World Cup. The 82 Brazil team was one of the favorites. Now look at the names that were on the Brazil team. Zico, Socrates, Falcao, Eder, Junior. Brazilian football was at its top then. They were one of the favorites. They were one of the most stylish teams going. This was what they called Jogo Bonito. They had 15 goals in five games, but lost against Italy in that 3-2 game. And Italy stung them on counterattacks. And they were in transition defensively. That was their frailty. That was their weakness. That was their soft underbelly. But that was that 3-2 loss to Italy, and that was in Barcelona, was one of the most defining moments, certainly in this World Cup, but even overall, because there was so much poetry and visual just eye candy when it came to Brazil's team and the way they played the game. And then it was, in some ways, a lot of people thought it was tragic because out goes this beautiful footballing. I love Socrates because he was this tall, 6'3" guy. They used to show him at training. He'd be smoking a cigarette. He was, I believe, a doctor or a dentist as well. But he just played the game so elegantly. And, of course, I mean, Zico is Zico, right? One of the greatest ever. West Germany, pragmatic. Obviously, West Germany had won the 74 World Cup. Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, Paul Breitner was on the winning team back then. Lothar Matthäus now was becoming important. Typical German, pragmatic, efficient. Beat Austria in a game that eliminated Algeria. And, of course, in that game, apparently, with both teams knowing that they would advance, they kind of stopped playing, and it created a lot of controversy because they both knew they were moving forward. So that's when you now know that you get your final group games being played simultaneously, so nobody can do that. They have to play to win or draw. Crazy semifinal against France for West Germany, 3-3 draw, 5-4 on penalty kicks. That was the legendary game where Patrick Battistone was running forward, you know, chasing a ball. Harald Schumacher came out and a violent challenge, just absolutely smashed Battistone, injured him badly. And that was kind of it. France rising in the world game now with Michel Platini. They start to become a little more evident in you know, their game. Cameroon, representing Africa, it gets into their first World Cup, and now people are starting to get alerted to the quality in Africa. Again, the artistry of Brazil was one of the keys, played out of a 4-2-2-2 system. Italian Catenaccio and the ultra-defensive was beginning to kind of break. It wasn't all about that. Italian soccer became a little bit more flexible at this point now. Conditioning, the physical side of the game, pressing a little more now is becoming a little bit more evident. And, of course, the global cultural impact of the World Cup, again, huge. And you had the passion of all the great Spanish soccer fans as well. So Italy wins a World Cup. At this time, they equal Brazil, who has three. Paolo Rossi, the redemption of him coming back after being banned from playing, and then becoming a world champion and a legend in this World Cup after not doing anything in the group stages and just coming to life in the knockout. That was the big story. And then you had a bit of a power shift. Europe winning it takes it back from South America, and South America was dominant in the 70s. And the Tardelli celebration, you will never forget that. So incredible World Cup 1982, a lot going on. I was over in Newcastle, England at the time, actually, staying with an English FA coach named Stan Nixon. I got that set up with one of my college teammates. I had a couple college teammates from Newcastle, Sean Green, who's at Central Connecticut State College now, Ian McDonald. These two guys helped set up a trip to Newcastle. So there you go. 1982 World Cup. It was a special one. And when we do that film down in Market Square, you're not going to want to miss it. Okay, we're going to take a break here again. We remind you FWC26Houston.com. Merchandise, tickets, information on volunteer. I mean, the volunteer turnout was incredible. FWC26Houston.com. This is Destination 2026, Houston's Countdown to the Cup, brought to you by Houston Methodist, Coca-Cola Southwest, Energy Quanta, Aramco, and Visit Sugarland. I'm Glenn Davis. Let's take a break. Let's come back. We'll talk the Three Lions of England.
This is ESPN 97.5. You're listening to Destination 2026, Houston's Countdown to the Cup.
Presented by Coca-Cola Southwest, Houston Methodist, NRG, and Quanta.
From the Huntington Bank Studios, here's Glenn Davis.
All right, welcome back to Destination 2026, Houston's Countdown to the Cup, brought to you by Houston Methodist, Coca-Cola Southwest, Energy, Quanta, Aramco, Visit Sugarland. Hey, you can hit me up at Glenn Davis SOC, S-O-C. At Soccer Matters GD. I remind you again, follow, like, comment, ask what you would like on the show. It's all open for you. Again, that's Soccer Matters GD at Glenn Davis Sock, both on X and Instagram. And you can also go to Glenn Davis Sock on Facebook. Okay. FWC26Houston.com. That's where you get the merchandise. Preparations are continuing. You see it around town as we welcome you back. We now decide to talk one of the teams that have qualified. England smashed Latvia 5-0. Let's bring in Warren Barton, who's been capped by England, a former Newcastle United defender. All right, so let's start off. I'm really excited to talk to you about the English national thing. England qualify. They smash Latvia. So let's talk about just the qualification, where the English fan is, because we always hear this, the English fans are over the top with what they think is going to happen. Your take?
I mean, the record was phenomenal. We took all the goals that they were scoring. It was an easier group, you know, when you look at it, but nothing's easy until you go out and play. It's got a great array of talent. He was given a great foundation from Gareth Southgate as well. Harry Kane is arguably the best, I think, complete number nine in the world at the moment. He's going from strength to strength. His knowledge now, maybe playing in the Bundesliga and, you know, different environments, has made it even better. And he's got some wonderful players around that can support and go forward. I think when you look at the World Cup, and we're all looking forward now to that, Glenn, it's, you know, only months away now, where it was years away, it's only months away. So you look at that. I still look at, you know, Argentina, Brazil, France, you know, look at Spain, but England are in and around, and we get excited. We start saying it's coming home. It hasn't been home for a bloody long time. The women, the Lionesses, have done great. There's now pressure coming on the men's team because they've gone out and won a major competition. The rugby team have done well. The women's rugby team, they've won a competition. So now it's down to the men. And Thomas Tuchel has gone about his job quietly, astutely in what he's done. I was a little bit, you know, we didn't see him, you know, he got the job in September, and then we didn't really see him going to too many stadiums looking at players. But he obviously has a good understanding of the Premier League and the mentality of the English players, and particularly young players. He's done a very good job at Chelsea. So very optimistic, but we're not under any illusion of what's happened in recent tournaments. And all I can say with Gareth Southgate, he got us to finals. He got us into competitions. And if it wasn't for maybe a penalty miss and a little rub at the green here or there. But I still think you look at Spain, you look at France, going into a tournament, South American teams will have an influence as well because of the heat, the conditions as well. But I think if England can get it right and people stay fit, I'm optimistic. I think we can have a good World Cup. And we wasn't here in 94. We didn't make it. I was actually part of that little group that wasn't involved, actually, with Graham Taylor. I was on the outside looking in, but that's a World Cup that we missed. And it's one, obviously, that I'll be working with Fox. I'll be looking forward to it. And hopefully I'll be flying my flag late into that tournament. So it'd be nice.
Well, I would think you would be on the England game. So let's see what
No,
happens.
Glenn, don't go. For some reason, I don't get put on the England. Maybe I'm too biased, but I've never done an England game. So that's probably someone else's job. But we'll see. We'll wait and see.
All right. He's Warren Barton. Newcastle United has played for England. By the way, Warren's going to get honored with the legacy cap on the 13th of November when England plays Serbia at Wembley. Explain the legacy cap to my listeners.
Yeah, I mean, what the FA Football Association have done with any ex-England player, and it goes way back to the 19th century when you first get the players that have gone through every player that has represented his country through the First World War, Second World War, and then into the new millennium, of get their own number. I'm 1,061. So what they've done with any player that's got a cap, whether it's one cap or 100 caps, you get your own legacy cap. It's the red one. They started doing this a few years ago with the new players that get into the England team. Because in past gone by, Glenn, they would give you a cap for each game. I remember being with the legendary Peter Shilton at Wembley, and you know, he had 125 caps. And I said, well, where are they? And they was in a black bin bag in the attic somewhere. So you get a cap, and you used to get a cap all the time, a navy cap for every time you play. But this time they want to give you a legacy cap. It's your number. You have that until. So I'm very honoured. It's the Serbia game, and they've done it for a lot of players that have gone through over the years. So it's my turn. I reached out to the FA that I was going over there for Newcastle, going to watch the Man City game. I was invited over as a guest there for Newcastle, and the FA have found out and said, well, we'd love to have you to come to Wembley. So it's a great opportunity. My eldest son will come with me, so it's always nice to have that. And when I've gone, I'll probably give it to him. He can have it. So we'll see. But yeah, very honoured. Been some great players, obviously, that have played, and I was lucky enough to get a few caps. Not as many as I would have liked, Glenn, but I still got one. That doesn't matter.
Fantastic honoring. Congratulations to you, Warren. All right, let's talk a little bit about the England youth. You know, I was looking at the roster before doing this interview with you, and I'm looking at Cole Palmer, Kobbie Mainoo, Curtis Jones, Jude Bellingham, Bukayo Saka, Mark Gooey. This is a lot of young talent, that Thomas Tuchel has at his disposal.
And different makers as well. I think when you go into a tournament, you have your stability players, but you need players to come in, particularly later on in the tournament, where hopefully you go a little bit deeper and you're playing games quite quickly to come on and change it. I mean, you know, Palmer's won, Saka's won. You said Jude Bellingham. That's quite interesting, Glenn, with the way he handled Jude Bellingham, Thomas Tuchel. Very German, if you like. You know, you're not fit enough. You haven't played enough games. I'm going to go without you. And now the pressure is on Bellingham, you know. But he'll play. He's no doubt he's an outstanding player. You know, he's very vocal. He's obviously a leader, but still someone that's very young. But he still builds around Harry Kane. Ollie Watkins has proved that he can come in and be a decent standing player. But, yeah, very exciting players. He can change formations. You can go three at the back. And he's bedding in. You know, people like James will feel comfortable because of his relationship with Thomas Tuchel at Chelsea. So, yeah, I mean, tactically, he'd be a little bit more astute of what he's doing because that's his philosophy. He's very tactically aware of how he sets up his teams. But the talent that he's got, if it's not working with 15, 20 minutes to go, he can bring players on. And what he's been able to do, which is impressive with me, is kept a happy, disciplined camp. You know, you don't hear too many rumours about, you know, players being left out. He's looking around at different areas, you know, and looking to bring a different dimension to the team. So, yeah, as I said, I'm excited. The jury was out at the beginning because I think people was looking at other coaches and he was probably one of the best who was available. I think everybody would want Pep, whoever that was. But he was one that was available after what happened with the previous club. So, yeah, I think he's gone into it, but he's got a lot of talent and he's doing well. You know, as I said, they're scoring goals and not conceding. That's a good recipe to do well in a tournament.
Do you think these young guys understand and go through a thought process when a German coach is coming in, they think about him, his tendencies, fact that he might be a little more autocratic? Do you think they understand his personality and adjust to it in this day and age?
Yeah, players talk, and obviously with his reputation at Chelsea coming. I just remember when Sven came into the England setup, he backed to the players. There's no Steven Gerrard just come out with it. When Sven took over, he wanted to be Beckham's friend. He wanted to be out with all. Where Thomas Tuchel has said, "No, I know you're talented. I know you're good players, but this is how we're going to do it. And Gareth had done that to an extent. He got that.
So the Sven, the Sven thing is the old, you know, if I'm taking over the team, I got to make sure the two biggest stars on the team are in my camp, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that was just so, the camp was so divided. And I was not part of it, but I knew what was going on. You had the Man United players, never spoke to the Chelsea players, never spoke to the Liverpool players. And Sven did nothing about that. He went right in with the Man United players. He was like, I want to go to film premieres. I want to go. And I don't like talking about someone that's no longer winners because he was a wonderful coach. But
correct.
He did make his bed by saying that, that's how we go. I think when you look at that team, you know, Cole, Terry, you know, Ferdinand, Gerrard, Scholes, Lampard, how can you not? Yeah. They're totally different to this group of players. You know, if you put them game to game, you think that group of players were by far the best players. But he did make them into a team. There were so many clicks, so many divided. And, you know, Neville was part of that as well. As soon as they finished their food, they all went away. There was no mixing with anything. It was United and, you know, Manchester United, and that's how they're going to do it. And they all went off to their rooms. And, you know, Steven Gerrard's not going to buckle to that either. So he stood his ground. And then you've got John Terry standing his ground. So, you know, that's how you want to go against about how you want a team to be successful and knit together.
I think this is a really interesting point you're bringing up, because people forget that, and it's no different with Spain, with Real Madrid players and Barcelona players. And what did he do?
He got them, the coach got them all in a room and said, if we want this country to win a major competition, you lot have got to get on and just head it out in front of it. And don't leave that room until everybody's bought in. And if no one's bought in, say Sergio Ramos would have said, I ain't doing it. I think at that time he would have said, get out then. We're not going to win anything. But they didn't. They bought into it. The country is bigger than any club. But because of how the Manchester United philosophy had been with Sir Alex Ferguson, it was them against the world. And they was bigger and more important than anybody else. And Neville being, you know, how he is anyway, you can see how he is in the media now and how he's been. He was like the general for Sir Alex. So when they went away, they weren't mixing with anybody. And it was so obvious. You know, as I said, I was only involved in one or two camps, but they left. They went in their room. So there was no conversation with Scholes or Beckham and that. They all went away. And it's hard to have that chemistry. And I think any great athlete, you've got to put your pride aside and say, right, if you're doing it for your country, we're all in together. Because there's no doubt that them players were good enough to do well. But you had so many, you know, so many divides in that camp.
Warren Barton joining us, former Newcastle United defender, capped by England. He will be on the World Cup for Fox in the coverage this summer. I got to talk to you about Harry Kane. I love this athlete, and I'll tell you why I love him. I'm an old school guy. I like the humble, get it done athlete. Not the one that's, and I know it's a different time period, so I'm dating myself here, technology, social media. But I just love how he's able to, well, I look at him and I just see 100% footballer, respect for the game, all the things that I know you grew up with, the things that I grew up with in New Jersey. I just love that about him, and I love seeing him playing the way he is for Bayern Munich. Speak to me about his humility, and then speak to me a little bit about, you know, are we talking about a playmaker here or a goal scorer or both?
I think what Harry Kane had in his early career has obviously had adversity, was told he wasn't good enough when he was a young kid at Arsenal. Said he was overweight, chubby, I think the coach said to him, wasn't going to make it. He went and played lower leagues for Leyton Orient, Leicester at the time, who was lower league. So he's had to earn the rights. And there's nothing wrong, Glenn, of being old school. I think we get caught up about the modern game. And I was talking to an academy coach last night at San Diego Football Club. The fundamentals, and he's worked at Man City, Liverpool, and now he's in the MLS. The fundamentals of what the game is have not changed 20 years to now. Personality have changed. Players have changed. Social media have changed. The image has changed. But with Harry Kane, he's very much in the sense of, like, I'm going to let my football do the talking. You know, he goes about that business. You've seen, you know, other players. You know what? No earrings, no tattoos. He just does his business. And I like that. You know, I think we're cut from the same cloth, Glenn, where you want people to go out there. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that now, whether that's in the NFL, whether that's hockey, whether that's basketball, whether that's baseball. But there's nothing wrong with being a bit of an old school and doing the right fundamentals. And then obviously you let your personality come out. But we get caught up in a lot of players want to be players before you earn the right to be a player. You have to train. you have to do your trade. You have to go and do weights. You have all of the fundamentals of working hard. Like, you know, adversity. My young son was in the team, out the team. I said the only way to get back in it is work hard. There's no magic wand. You can't sulk. You can't ask to move. You can't. You've got to roll your sleeves out. And Harry, I think Harry Kane epitomizes that in a modern game. And I
look at guys like Andreas Iniesta, Luka Modric. I love these guys because they're not doing anything other than showing you what they do on the field and leading by example. And it's refreshing, I think, in this day and age.
I would say as well, Lamar at Barcelona in Spain, he lives his life, but he's performing. And there's nothing wrong with that. If you're, you know, the problem with Neymar when he was living his life, he got injured. It was, you know, there was, so you've got to make sure that if you're going to live your life, you've got to go out and perform and go well. I just think Harry Kane has elevated his game. Going back to your second question as well, I think he's both. I think he's a proven goal scorer, but he can drop deep. He's, as I said, the most complete number nine, because you talk about number nine in our era, was a post-up, centre-forward, sure. Turn, score goals.
Keep the depth, stay as deep as possible.
Run the channels, work defenders. The modern-day number nine, you come deep to create space for other players, you've become a playmaker, and he's been able to – he's arguably one of the best passers of the ball. You know, he's a better passer than Jude Bellingham, you know, who's a midfield player. He's a better passer than Jordan Henderson, these type of players. So I think with what he's done, you know, going to Bayern Munich has really given him a lease of life. I love that about a player as well. Go to a different country. He could have stayed in the Premier League and probably broke Alan Shearer's record the way he was going. He might even still come back and do that. But he's gone away to experience something different. And I love the Bundesliga. I've worked on it for a few years. He's going to go to a club that's always in the Champions League. And I think he's, as I said, the most complete number nine that England's probably ever had. You know, Alan Shearer was arguably one of the best number nines, and you go way, way back to other players. But this guy is you know, humble with what he does. And I go back to his beginning. He's had to earn the right to do that. And, you know, he understands it could have gone the other way, and he might be working on the building site, but he's not. He's playing for England. Yeah. He's a record goal scorer. And he's a world-class player. So, great credit to him and his family. Obviously, he's got good people around him, a good family person as well. But he's let his football do the talking. And I think Mbappe started to do that a little bit. He got caught up 3 years ago, 2 years ago, about the lights, about the other side of the game, which is hard, Glenn, because young players get social media, they get invited everywhere, you can do this. And it's a big part of being a modern athlete. You have to be engaging with your fans and your networking people. But he's sort of turning around. There's no coincidence now that he's scored 15 goals in his last 10 games for club and country. And I think he's matured a little bit in the last 18 months. I think, shit, you know, I better get on with my game and be the player that I can be. And he is a world-class player and arguably going to be France's, you know, out-and-out top goal scorer as well, because he's got, you know, Henri looking at him, scrutinising him and telling him what he's doing wrong. So, you know, he'll want to prove that I'm as good as you, if not better. And that's a great compliment for someone like Mbappe, because for me, Henri was the best player that played in the Premier League.
Yeah, I like listening to him.
And still is, actually.
Warren, thank you very much for coming on tonight. By the way, enjoy your celebration getting the legacy cap when England plays Serbia at Wembley, November 13th. As always, it's a pleasure talking to you. I love having you on the show. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, gang. Good luck to you, my friend.
All right, great stuff there talking about England. Is it coming home? Well, when you go through the names of the youth on that English national team, they have to be considered one of the teams that could potentially take the World Cup. I know that always happens, but England with that base of youth who are playing in the world's greatest league, you can't turn your head to them, no question about it. By the way, the last World Cup in Qatar, the United States national team could not produce a winning goal, but drew with England and outplayed them in midfield. Tyler Adams, Weston McKinney outplayed the English national team in that World Cup. Not a lot of people talk about that. I always bring that up. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back with more. It's Destination 2026, Houston's Countdown to the Cup, brought to you by Houston Methodist, Coca-Cola Southwest Energy, Quanta, Aramco, and Visit Sugarland. More soccer talk to come. The World Cup is around the corner here in Houston, Texas. We'll
This is Destination 2026, Houston's Countdown to the Cup.
Presented by Coca-Cola Southwest, Houston Methodist, NRG, and Quanta.
From the Huntington Bank Studios, here's Glenn Davis.
All right, welcome back to Destination 2026, Houston's Countdown to the Cup. Brought to you by Houston Methodist, Coca-Cola Southwest, Aramco Energy, Quanta, Visit Sugarland, and your host Glenn Davis here. So, you know, I was thinking before the show, let's get into stadiums. And obviously, it is summertime. If you remember the 1994 World Cup, the heat and the summer was a bit of an issue at the World Cup. Well, we have one of the dome stadiums that are involved in this 2026 FIFA World Cup. That goes across the United States, Canada, and Mexico, three host countries. So we're 232 days away, and I thought, let's do a deep dive on venues, because we'll figure out where these games are going to be played and get this out to the public. So in the U.S., we'll have 11 sites: Atlanta, Georgia; Boston, Massachusetts; Dallas, technically Arlington; right here in Houston; Kansas City, Missouri; Los Angeles; Miami; New York; New Jersey. Technically, it's New Jersey. MetLife Stadium. Philadelphia; San Francisco Bay Area; and Seattle, Washington. Canada: Toronto and Vancouver. And then Mexico: Guadalajara, Monterrey. And then the opener will take place in the legendary Azteca Stadium in Mexico City. So how about capacities? So Azteca Stadium's got the largest capacity at 87,000. Monterrey, 53,500. That's the Estadio BBVA. That is an absolutely gorgeous stadium. Guadalajara, it'll be at the Estadio Akron, 49,000 fans. Past World Cups, it was held at the legendary Jalisco Stadium. Toronto, Canada, BMO Field, 45,000. It's been expanded. Vancouver, 54,000. BC Place. I've actually called some games in BC Place for the Women's World Cup. Dallas, AT&T Stadium, 80,000. Atlanta, Mercedes-Benz, 71,000. Right here, Energy Stadium, 72,000 plus. L.A., Inglewood, 70,000. Seattle, 68,000. San Francisco, Levi's Stadium, 68,000. Philadelphia, 67,000. Miami, 64,000 plus. And Boston, 64,000 plus. All right. 104 games over the 16 host cities. The naming rights of stadiums will be suspended, and the venues will be referred to by the city name during the tournament. FIFA has a lot of rules that have to be followed, as the Houston committee so knows. There are different zones: west, central, and east, which is supposedly going to help reduce the travel during the group stages. Because of it being a first ever 48-team tournament, there are more matches than usual. So more venues and more early knockout rounds. Estadio Azteca. And this is where the very first game of the tournament will be. This is, in the grand scheme of things, this is one of the great temples in the history of the World Cup, Azteca Stadium, or Estadio Azteca. And it has hosted incredibly legendary moments here. So let's talk about a couple of them, because that's where it'll kick off in 232 days. So let's go right to the 1970 World Cup. Brazil win this World Cup 4-1. Mexico falls in love with Brazil and their style of play, the country. They beat Italy 4-1 in the final. Pelé, at this moment, becomes the first player to win three World Cups. The type of soccer that they were playing was ridiculous. There is a nine-pass move, and it goes down in history as one of the greatest team goals ever scored. You know, we often look at the final touch applied or the final finish, but you know, goals to me encompass build up and a lot of things that happened prior for it to even come to a culmination of scoring a goal. Well, there was one build up, nine passes. Pelé gets the ball top of the box. He's facing the Italian defense, and all of a sudden Carlos Alberto, the great defender who also played at the New York Cosmos with Pelé, comes screaming down the right side. Pelé lays off the perfectly weighted pass, and Alberto hits this thing in stride. And I mean, just lashes it in. And that's called one of the greatest team goals ever in World Cup history. Remember it immensely. And it, you know, it, a third World Cup, this kind of cements Pelé's legacy. He's done it in a short amount of time. And Brazil basically is this mystifying team now around the world. 70 World Cup, you had the semifinal where Italy beat West Germany 4-3. They called that the quote-unquote the game of the century. I don't know if that's more important than the final in Pelé's group, but extra time, five goals. Gianni Rivera, the game winner in the 111th minute. That's a big Italian name. And there's still a plaque outside the stadium, apparently, that read to the game of the century at Azteca. So now we move on to 86. Okay, we got to go into Maradona's hand of God. This would be the second Argentine triumph. They would win the World Cup, but Maradona punches a ball in with his fist along the side of his head past Peter Shilton. You could see the reaction of the English. This was in the quarterfinal, and they called it, Maradona called it the hand of God. And yes, it was controversial, but nobody forgets it. And then in that same game, 4 minutes later, after that hand of God goal, Maradona dribbles 60 yards. He beats five English guys. I think he beat Terry Butcher, the defender, twice. Butcher got beat early in the sequence. He ran back, and I think Maradona beats him again, or close to beats him again. Many say the greatest goal in the history of the World Cup. And then in the final, Argentina beats West Germany 3-2. 114,000 fans winning their second title. And he just orchestrated the team, basically, in this. I mean, this was incredible theater. It was one man putting a team on his back. Many people say, oh, he didn't have the support system. I'm not so sure about that. But they'll try to compare Maradona to Messi winning a World Cup and saying Messi had a better support system. We can argue that till the end of the day for sure. But that was a significant part of what happened in Azteca Stadium. I also remember the side volley that Manuel Negrete hit for Mexico. He dipped his right shoulder and hit a slashing side volley that screamed into the back of the net, and Mexican fans went nuts. That, to me, is also one of the biggest moments ever of that 86 World Cup. Manuel Negrete, who I was fortunate to play against once when he was on Pumas. Little guy, but what a player. And Mexican fans remember him. I think I did an interview with him many, many years ago. All right. Azteca Stadium is also the home of Club America, who, by the way, this past weekend got beat in the Young Mexico City Derby 2-1 by Cruz Azul. But Club America has played in there for many, many times. And the Mexican national team has won many big games in that stadium. The altitude, the atmosphere was always a big home advantage. I don't think that still exists now. I think that's been chipped away a little bit. I don't think teams are as intimidated to go play Mexico there. The England-Argentina game from that 86 was big. You had the 1999 FIFA Confederations Cup. I actually attended that with my good friend Efrain Flores. Mexico beating Brazil 4-3. That was a huge, huge upset. That was the team of Cuauhtémoc Blanco and Miguel Zapata. And that was Mexico's first major FIFA trophy. So that remains a big piece in Mexican soccer history. And it is the only stadium, Azteca, to ever host two World Cup finals, 1970 and 1986, one by Brazil and one by Argentina. And in 2026, it will become the first stadium to host three different World Cups. So that's some pretty cool history. And I think exceptional that the World Cup kicks off in that stadium 232 days from today. Now, let me get you a little bit into Houston and what's going on at Energy Stadium. We've had David Fletcher on from Lone Star Sports and Entertainment. Again, we're going to host seven matches here, five group stage matches, two knockout stage, including a round of 16. Big deal is switching, obviously, to the natural grass. So right after the rodeo's over, I mean, this is astounding stuff to me that you can get this stadium growing its own grass right after the amount of people involved with the rodeo. And I'm talking about people actually attending the rodeo. And now you're going to get this thing ready for the greatest sporting event in the world. It's mind-boggling. I wouldn't even know where to begin. Obviously, FIFA has the field getting widened out to 73 yards. The NFL, it's much narrower. They had to remove seats in the corner to accommodate that. They're replacing seats at the stadium, new seat backs. They're just getting it spit-shined and ready for the World Cup. It's hard to believe it's here. I mean, sometimes I just pinch myself. But in May, after the rodeo, they'll start with the turf. You got the Fan Festival. This is going to be the most culturally connected World Cup ever, with technology, arts, food, music, all of things that are affect us as human beings globally. Fan Festival is going to have a giant screen. It's going to be down in Edo. I believe it's a German company that's going to kind of put this all together. Interactive activities. There's food courts, mini soccer fields. There's going to be a lot of water, I'm sure. And the Fan Festival is going to be open in Houston, from what I understand and what I'm reading, 34 of the 39 tournament days. So it'll be a place for football fans to gather. It'll be party central for sure. $100 million is being invested in hotel expansion and new development ahead of the tournament. There's all kinds of beautification progress going on, improvements in downtown. You see people working on roads. Those potholes are going to get filled, hopefully. And then they're going to have kind of a pedestrian promenade along Main Street. So there you go. The biggest thing is obviously going to be security in the world climate right now. And these big events, sometimes the security budget is off the charts. So that's going to be a huge expense. And then what else? I mean, look, Houston is proven when it comes to doing events, Super Bowls, Final Fours. This is a whole nother kettle of fish, though. This is seven games, and this is a lot of people that are going to be milling around for about a month. I still think there's going to be a lot of people that come here and base out of Houston and go to games in Dallas and Kansas City and other places. So natural grass being installed, a big one. Transportation, public infrastructure, how you move people. Hopefully we'll hear more about that. And of course, it's very hot and humid here. So yeah, maybe in Edo, people are going to be hot. But, you know, we have one of the stadiums that has a roof on it, along with Atlanta and Vancouver. So, you know, you're going to be in a little bit more comfort here in Houston, Texas. So it's exciting. It's 232 days away, the kickoff. And Friday, July 2026, it'll all begin at Azteca Stadium in Mexico City. All right, that's going to do it tonight for Destination 2026, brought to you by Coca-Cola Southwest, Houston Methodist Energy, Quanta, Visit Sugarland. We thank everybody for tuning in tonight. And don't forget, we've got Gole, 1982 World Cup film in Market Square. That's outside, 6 to 8 p.m. Central, for information on that. And that 1982 World Cup, which we described tonight, you go to Monday Night Football, F-U-T-B-O-L, 1982.eventbrite.com. We'll see you down there for that. These are really fun. Meeting some really, really cool soccer-related and like-minded individuals at these events. There's networking going on at these events. Batiri has done a great job, the artist, in setting these up and curating them. And I've been honored to be co-hosting some of these with him. So get down there. Let's keep having fun. The World Cup is a celebration of the great game of football and the great game of humanity. And it does bring people together. All right, that does it tonight for Destination 2026. Until next Tuesday in Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5. I'm Glenn Davis. Big thanks to Brian McDonald for all his great producing. I do want to thank Slip Sliders for bringing food in. They're down on bins in the museum district. Best sliders going. You heard it from me. That'll do it tonight. Until next Tuesday, I'm Glenn Davis. Remember, Destination 2026. We are hosting the World Cup here in Houston, Texas.